Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the president meeting with congressional leaders to get them to buy into his strategy to deal with the Islamic State in Syria and Iraq, as Secretary of State Kerry meets with Jordan's king, then goes to Saudi Arabia to meet with Saudi leaders and the foreign ministers of Egypt, the Gulf states, and Iraq to come up with both a political consensus and a military strategy to implement the president's plan, which will be announced to the nation on Wednesday. Richard Barrett, who sits on the boards of the International Center for Counterterrorism in The Hague and the Center for Global Counterterrorism Cooperation in Washington, joins us to discuss the complexities and contradictions of the region that America may not understand and cannot deal with alone. Then, with a new Federal Reserve report just out that finds the rich are getting richer, with the top 3% accounting for 30.5% of all income, controlling 54.4% of the nation's wealth in 2013, up from 44.8% in 1989, while the share of the bottom 90% fell to 24.7% compared to 33.2% in 1989, we will speak with Jan Rivkin, the chair of the strategy unit at Harvard Business School, about a new survey of business school alumni that he co-chaired, An Economy Doing Half Its Job, which highlights a troubling divergence in the U.S. economy where American companies are winning in global markets but not lifting the living standards of the average American. We will discuss the survey's finding that with polarized and paralyzed politics and a crumbling educational system, we are at a critical moment for the nation in which business leaders and policymakers need a strategy to get America on a path towards broader shared prosperity. Then finally, we will examine how political spending is turning American democracy into a marketplace with Timothy Kuhner, a professor of law at Georgia State University College of Law and author of the new book just out, Capitalism versus Democracy, Money in Politics and the Free Market Constitution. We will discuss how, as elections become more and more expensive, the need for more and more money is turning our legislators into telemarketers. And joining us now is Richard Barrett, who's the director of the Sufan Group, a New York-based security consultancy company. He sits on the boards of the International Center for Counterterrorism in The Hague and the Center for Global Counterterrorism Cooperation in Washington, and he was the coordinator of the Al-Qaeda and Taliban monitoring team at the United Nations in New York, appointed by UN Secretary General, and helped establish a system-wide United Nations Working Group on Terrorism, which became the United Nations Counterterrorism Implementation Task Force. Welcome to Background Briefing, Richard Barrett.
Thank you.
And the president on Tuesday is meeting with congressional leaders, trying to get them to buy in to whatever it is that he's going to be announcing to the American people on Wednesday in terms of a strategy to combat the Islamic State. And the Secretary of State, Kerry, on Tuesday is meeting in Jordan, where, of course, they're very nervous, the Hashemite Kingdom, with ISIS fighters on its borders, not to mention hundreds of thousands of Syrian refugees that they have to take care of. And then on Wednesday, Secretary of State Kerry will be talking in Saudi Arabia with the foreign ministers of Egypt, Jordan, and the six Gulf Arab states, as well as Iraq. It's going to be a bit of a hard sell, isn't it, to get these Gulf states and Saudi Arabia, who've invested so much in getting rid of Assad, saying now we've got to turn our attention on getting rid of the only people who seem to be a military threat to Assad.
Yes, I think the basic problem there, though, for the United States in dealing with the Gulf states and others in the Middle East is that there has to be a division of responsibility. And I think the United States sees more of the burden falling on the shoulders of the regional powers. And maybe they rely too much on the United States to provide the initiators and so on, which will bring about change. And I think that that's still a negotiation in train. And certainly, President Obama, as we all know, has come under criticism domestically for not doing more. But in many ways, one can sympathize with him because the region is really quite complicated and you get all sorts of different currents, not just the sectarian ones, but of course, different approaches to politics, whether or not people support the Muslim Brotherhood or a more autocratic style of government and so on. In the meantime, I reckon that Jordan, as you say, Saudi Arabia, to a certain extent as well, I hope, and Turkey will see their vulnerabilities of being on the borders of Syria and Iraq and will want something done to at least stabilize the situation and help a new government in Iraq to establish itself with more credibility and support from the Iraqi people, if only to push ISIS back into Syria more so that then a more sort of deliberate, perhaps, and longer-term campaign could be mounted there.
But in terms of Saudi Arabia and the Emirates, they both have very state-of-the-art air forces. And I'm wondering whether, you know, given that the U.S. is going alone at this moment and trying to get allies to help out, it seems to me fairly unlikely that the Saudis will want to be bombing their co-religionists. I believe King Abdullah's wife or mother comes from an Iraqi tribe. And furthermore, my understanding is that the Saudis are building a wall across that border between Iraq and Saudi Arabia, which is manned at the moment by both Egyptian and Pakistani mercenaries. And this assumption being that the Saudis can't even trust their own army in terms of ISIS. Is that your understanding?
Yes, I'm not sure whether I would call some of those foreign troops mercenaries or assistance provided at a cost by other states. I mean, Saudi Arabia has, of course, a very close relationship at the moment with Egypt and, of course, historically with Pakistan as well. And I guess both those countries might be willing to go and lend a hand. But, it's strange enough to see American aircraft and Iranian aircraft engaged in the same campaign, and it would be even odder to see American, Iranian, and Saudi aircraft all combined against the same target. That would be quite extraordinary. But in a sense, it's what the region needs. It has to have, particularly Saudi Arabia and Iran, to sit down together and work out what's going to be done. You know, this is a threat to both of them. And, of course, Iran has benefited enormously from the past years, particularly, of course, since 2003 and the overthrow of Saddam Hussein. They've done very well indeed, and they've made huge strides, huge gains in the region. But they probably realize that they have to allow the pendulum to swing back a bit in order to be able to have something that's sustainable. And Saudi Arabia, on the other hand, I think is also tied up with its competition with Iran, and probably feels, well, Iran really is on the back foot now. But equally, they have to allow, in my view, Iran to maintain some of its increased sort of influence, just because it's so important to have an inclusive government in Iraq.
But everybody says that, don't they, Richard Barrett, that it's important to have an inclusive government in Iraq. But is that a chimera? I mean, this is a country that's broken and divided, and the Kurds have pretty much gone their own way. What is the enticement for the Sunni to stay in Iraq, particularly now that we are standing up a new government, or a new government is standing up in Baghdad, that if the Sunni-dominated Iraqi army is sent back into Anbar to take on the Islamic State, they're not going to be welcomed as liberators?
Well, no, and indeed I think that was also true in recent campaigns, for example, in Amali, where the Iraqi army is essentially a load of Shia militia, and the Shia militia have perhaps no better reputation among the Sunni than the Islamic State does. And so that there's a lot of sorting out to be done. But if you imagine that Iraq could be divided into three, with the Kurdish area, with the Sunni area, and the Shia area, I think that would have some repercussions which might not be particularly welcome in the region. For example, I think Turkey would be very concerned about even more independent Kurdish state in northern Iraq, which would clearly encourage Kurdish separatism in Turkey as well, and possibly in Iran, for that matter, in Syria. And then the Saudis would be very concerned about having the most resource-rich areas of Iraq essentially become part of Iran. I think that wouldn't be very popular at all. And then the Sunnis would get left with great, huge areas of land in which really there's very little. And I don't suppose they would be very happy about that either. I think they reckon that they have some interest vested in the resources of Iraq as a whole. And it wasn't very long after the American invasion of 2003 that people were beginning to talk about the possibility of splitting the country up. And everybody concluding that that just, A, wasn't desirable, but B, wasn't possible because the communities were so intertwined. And although that may be less true today than it was then, nonetheless, it wouldn't be an easy thing, I think, to draw the boundaries. The Sunnis would control the flow of water to the Shia areas. You know, the Kurds would be sort of pushing in all directions. And the Shia would remain if you like, a dominant group, because they would have the control of resources and indeed probably the capital.
So given Iran's influence over Iraq following the US invasion, which essentially took out the checks and balances, if you will, that Saddam Hussein represented against Iran, why is it then that the Iranians, to what extent do they influence and control the Shiite government? Because for the longest time, people have seen the writing on the wall with Maliki, and whereas George W. Bush spoke with him every day and tried to coach him to become a leader, I think Obama just wanted out of that place and didn't want anything to do with him. And in that period, it's just clearly gone from bad to worse, where the awakening people that helped the U.S. in the so-called surge, Maliki turned around and went after them, and not to mention al-Qaeda went after them too. So the whole story has been such a sorry one, and it's led us to this impossible situation. And I wonder, how come the Iranians weren't minding the store?
Well, I think it's a good question. They should have seen some of this coming, and they probably did. But, of course, Saddam Hussein really represented, 20-25% of the people in so far as he represented the Sunni, and he kept the Shia really in pretty close check, and of course the Kurds too, for that matter, and he was prepared to use chemical weapons against them if he felt they were getting too uppity. And he was a very, very ruthless leader, and I guess that has caused some very, very deep wounds within society in Iraq. And indeed, I think the Iranians saw the rise of the Shia government there, Maliki in particular, as a great opportunity for them. And they did exert quite a lot of influence over him, both, I think, through direct political influence and through less direct, perhaps, religious influence. But nonetheless, Maliki was in charge of the country. And although he relied a lot, I think, on Iran and tried to maintain a very close relationship, he also saw himself as someone who could reestablish Iraq as the dominant Arab state, or at least, you know, begin to move that way. And theoretically, it would be possible because, of course, Iraq is enormously wealthy in terms of oil resources. And it has had in the past good relations with most of the countries around, apart from Iran. So having got the Iranian thing sorted out, there was an opportunity. Well, Maliki blew that completely, of course, by either taking his revenge or feeling he didn't have to worry about the Sunni population there. And that was a miscalculation because, of course, it built up so much disaffection, alienation, and opposition, too, that when the Islamic State came in, there was a ready market for them. But I think in Maliki's defense, and I wouldn't presume, actually, to defend Maliki because I think he did a poor job, it wasn't until Syria collapsed that really he faced a serious problem. Sure, you can say, well, that the massacre at Hawija and the breaking up of the protest camp at Anbar, outside Ramadi and so on, were indications that things were going seriously wrong. And he was tending to be much more authoritarian than inclusive. But, I think that given time, Iran might have said, you've got to soften down here, you've got to quieten down there, we've got to come to some agreements. But it wasn't the biggest problem for them all. Now it's a huge problem for all of us, and I think it's a problem that has reminded the region that they can't just sit back and build a fence around the country or try in some other ways to immunize them against the political flows of sectarianism and tribal and ethnic disagreements, that they have to get together and decide, well, what sort of Middle East do we want? Do we want one within the existing borders? Do we want one that's more sort of loosely arranged? Do we want one that's going to entertain any sort of thoughts of democracy? What do we want? And how are we going to develop? How do we see our region in the next 20 years? And I don't think that anybody's been ready to do that. And I hope that at least if there's any silver lining to what's going on out there, it may be an occasion for them to sit down and say, look, we better talk before it gets too late.
But if indeed they are going to be talking, and of course the Deputy Foreign Minister of Iran met in Saudi Arabia a week ago, and presumably that in itself was an interesting development. But it's one thing to meet and talk about what needs to be done, and the next step is to actually do something. And that's where it seems that the U.S. is the so-called indispensable nation. And as the U.S. tries to find other partners, in particular military partners, and and the president, I think, is pretty firm about not wanting to put boots on the ground. What can be done in terms of Western input here? For example, the Associated Press is reporting that the CIA's approach to retired agency official with close ties to King Abdullah about setting up a task force to help Jordan deal with its threat from ISIS. What can Western armies do in that region? I mean, the idea that, for example, the Israelis helping out is, I think, an anathema, isn't it, to the Arabs?
Well, yeah, indeed, you know, it's another strange development of history, of course, that the Israeli and Saudi interests are so closely aligned at the moment.
Mm-hmm.
But let's just have a look at the region. I mean, first of all, yes, the Iranian deputy foreign minister going to Riyadh and sorting out an agreement about Maliki, the departure of Maliki and the replacement of Maliki and how things would work in Iraq. Well, that's useful. And that's useful that the two countries eventually, and that was after quite a lot of sort of rather sterile negotiation, the two countries were able to come to an agreement, and that was what resulted in Maliki going and a new government coming in and things sort of slightly moving forward, though I don't think the Sunni tribes in Iraq are at all convinced yet that it's going to make any difference at all. But if we continue around the region, I think that Turkey is indispensable in this as well as the United States, because Turkey, although it's going through a slightly strange phase itself, at least does have an awful lot of credibility in the Muslim world, and it has a sort of self-confidence, if you like, to be able to exert some sort of authority and some sort of regional strategic plan. And I think it's really important, therefore, for Turkey and the United States to be aligned in how they see the region developing and how they want to deal with the problems at the moment. And I guess the American reluctance to put boots on the ground is very understandable to everyone down there, but nonetheless, I think there is a great thirst for leadership, and if it's not from America, then maybe it should be Turkey, but if it's not from Turkey, where does it come from in the Arab world? And I think that's still a question that's very open. And Jordan, yeah, Jordan is an important country, but it's not a particularly strong country. It can provide intelligence support. It was very useful, for example, during the Iraq war in getting the Sawa, the Anbar Awakening, going, because the tribes just over the Jordanian border in Iraq, of course, were the crucial ones for that movement. And it's a good ally, but I don't think Jordan would want to stick its neck out too far, because it has its own internal problems. It's, an artificial construct, like so many of those countries there. And King Abdullah, he's not. People don't necessarily throw rose petals in his path when he walks down the streets of Amman. They all have difficulties. And the Israel-Palestine issue is sort of slightly out of it at the moment, but nonetheless, I don't think many states there can sort of watch what was happening in Gaza over 7 weeks and more and feel that, okay, we can talk to Israel very easily and do things with Israel. I mean, that is still a big, big ditch to jump, I guess. And I mean, Saudi as well. Saudi has its also lots of problems. Saudi has a big problem with the succession, and we're still in that generation of the king and his brothers, and it's got to move down one. And how are they going to do that? I don't think they really know how they're going to do that, nor what such a change is going to bring. They have a problem with Yemen, too, where Yemen has still not settled down. There's a lot of Al-Qaeda-type people down there. And indeed, the extremism in Saudi Arabia is an internal difficulty. They've just arrested another 88 people quite recently, many of whom had previously been in prison. So, it's a continuing problem. It's not one that's just suddenly arising. And then the question of the Gulf states, which you mentioned, the Emirates, sure, they want a quiet life. They do an awful lot of trade with Iran. But at the same time, they're closely allied with Saudi Arabia. And then Qatar, of course, is competitive in that it's supporting Muslim Brotherhood. It bet on the wrong color in Egypt. And so they're sort of wanting perhaps to get back in the game. There's so many different complexities there that I don't think it's reasonable to expect Chuck Hagel and John Kerry to just be able to go down and say, okay, guys, this is what we're going to do. And everybody sit around the table and say, oh, yeah, that's great. That's a good idea. Let's all get behind it.
Well, just in closing, Richard Barrett, things have to be changing, though, for Assad. And I'm wondering whether how long he can control this narrative that he is the only person that can protect the Alawites and the Christians from the Sunni majority and from this ISIL that he has essentially used to justify his brutality. I mean, if you have a situation now where it's going to require the West and Turkey and all these other players that we're talking about to take care of ISIS first in Iraq and then in Syria, doesn't that undercut Assad's entire narrative with his own people? And is that likely to lead to his downfall?
Well, Assad's not going to fall anytime soon, either to ISIS or to anybody else. The non-extremist rebels are very weak. And I saw even that a whole bunch of Ara al-Sham leaders were killed today in a bomb attack probably committed by ISIS. And Ara al-Sham was founded by al-Qaeda members. So you can see that the battling between the rebel groups goes all the way up and down. So Assad's there, and he'll control the towns. He won't control all the countryside, but he will control the towns, and ISIS will probably manage to hold on to areas of the north and the east. But the narrative that Assad puts out that he's fighting terrorists, of course, is increasingly validated by the various videos and other propaganda put out by ISIS, and nobody is in any doubt about that. But nonetheless, he's still a lousy ruler. He's still extremely unpopular with his people. And Sunnis are a majority in Syria. So something has to be done with Assad. And again, it's a question of whether there's any way that one can bring influences on Assad or make him see things in a different way without actually putting people in there to fight his forces. Because if you're going to fight ISIS, then it's not much of a jump to say, well, we're not going to fight ISIS to bolster Assad's position, so we might as well fight ISIS and then we'll fight Assad. And that, of course, would be getting into something which is completely unacceptable to the American people and probably to everybody else in the region. So how do we deal with Assad? Well, first of all, I think America and Russia have to agree that they want to deal with Assad and they want to sort out Syria. And if that happens, and that means that something has to happen on Ukraine and so on and so on and so on, but if it does happen, then sure, maybe an agreement could be reached. But it's, again, a very long road. And I don't see Assad saying, okay, I'm going to retire to Nice. I think that Assad will say, I'm going to hang on here. And he's still a young man. You say, I just was re-elected president for 7 years. And so I think it's a great mistake. If anybody thinks that Obama's going to come up on tomorrow, Wednesday, and with a plan that is like a light bulb going on, and everybody says, oh, he's got it. It's a long, long haul with many, many uncertainties ahead.
Well, Richard Barrett, I thank you so much for joining us. I appreciate it.
That's a pleasure.
Again, I've been speaking with Richard Barrett, who's the director of the Sufan Group, a New York-based security consultancy company. He sits on the boards of the International Center for Counterterrorism in The Hague and the Center on Global Counterterrorism Cooperation in Washington, and was a coordinator of the Al-Qaeda and Taliban monitoring team at the United Nations in New York, appointed by the UN Secretary General. And he helped establish the system-wide United Nations Working Group on Terrorism, which became the United Nations Counterterrorism Implementation Task Force. We're going to take a brief station break. We'll be back talking with the co-chair of a new study from Harvard Business School, An Economy Doing Half Its Job.
Brother, can you spare a dime?
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Jan Rifkin, who is the Bruce V. Rauner Professor and Chair of the Strategy Unit at Harvard Business School. His scholarly work has appeared in journals such as Management Science, Organization Science, the Strategic Management Journal, the Academy of Management Journal, Administrative Science Quarterly, and Research Policy. He's the co-chair of a new survey just out from the Harvard Business School highlighting a troubling divergence in the U.S. economy, an economy doing half its job. Welcome to Background Briefing, Jan Rifkin.
Ian, thank you so very much.
And the latest, the work that you've just put out is the latest in a series of annual surveys conducted by the Harvard Business School's U.S. Competitiveness Project, where every year you ask your alumni worldwide to share their perceptions about the current state and future trajectory of both U.S. competitiveness and the U.S. business environment. And I take it you've come up with some troubling findings here. The headlines that I've seen about your report basically are reinforcing an idea that the wealth gap in this country is widening.
So the survey this year really focuses on a troubling divergence in our economy. We see large and mid-sized firms in America rallying strongly from the Great Recession, and the professionals who run them doing quite well. On the other hand, we've got middle and working class citizens who are really struggling, as are small businesses.
So this, of course, coincides with a report just out from the Fed. It's an annual report on the study of consumer finances, and the Fed found that the wealthiest 3% of American households control 54.4% of the nation's wealth in 2013, which is substantially higher than the 44.8% that they held in 1989. And at the same time, the share of wealth held by the bottom 90% fell to 24.7% in 2013 compared to 33.2% in 1989. So the Fed is telling us that the income gains come from the wealthy, with the top 3% accounting for 30.5% of all income. So that's the environment in which you're working. But you have access to your alumni, many of whom, I presume, a lot of whom are successful businessmen. So what was the most surprising thing that you heard from them?
You know, I think that they reinforced some things that we had anticipated. The part of that was simply that the prospects for wage increases in America, in their eyes, are relatively dim, while the prospects for firms prospering are quite bright. We were, however, able to get a much better insight into exactly why that is, what underlies that divergence, and particularly by looking at different aspects of the U.S. business environment. When you look at those aspects and you ask the alumni to assess how healthy are they, what you find is that many of the aspects on which middle and working class Americans depend, things like the base of skilled labor in America or the quality of education, those things are weak or deteriorating. On the other hand, the elements on which firms depend, like the quality of management, the vibrancy of capital markets, the context for entrepreneurship, those things are thriving.
So the bottom line here is that, as your report points out, Jan Rifkin, that firms can escape the weakness in the U.S. business environment by moving abroad, but workers can't. And we've seen a lot of...
Many companies are one tax aversion from escaping, for instance, the convoluted tax code of America. On the other hand, citizens can't escape the vagaries of the political system by moving abroad.
So this ties in then with this new rash of corporate inversions?
So certainly, I think it's related. I mean, the weaknesses in the U.S. business environment include a number of things that are related to policy and to politics. The paralysis of the political system, the complexities and underlying costs of the tax code, the regulatory structure, all those things are making it difficult for businesses to look at the U.S. as a fantastic place to create new jobs.
But is there a cultural and social component here? In other words, is there such a thing as economic patriotism? And was there, for example, during the halcyon days of the American dream in the 1950s and 1960s, when the wealthy paid up to 92% tax under President Eisenhower, there seems to have been a sense of a social contract and that being an American meant something. And is this new survey that you're suggesting really indicating that perhaps we don't have that universal feeling of that we're all in it together?
You know, I think we can question whether the 1950s was a period of great economic patriotism or a period in which firms did not have the plethora of great alternatives that they've got today. I think in today's economy, we have to face up to the fact that businesses do have alternatives, and we need to attract them to our shores, not out of patriotism or altruism, but because this is a great place to do business. As an American, I certainly wish that businesses would be attracted here simply out of patriotism. As a realist, though, I've got to ask myself, can we make this a compelling place to do business? That's the basis on which we could have, you know, a secure future for the American middle class.
So, but just to touch on that point, my understanding is that the U.S. is actually a magnet for foreign investment and foreign capital. It's considered still the safest place to put your money.
It's certainly an attractive place, and when you look at the absolute levels of foreign direct investment, the United States is certainly a leader. When you look at the growth rates in foreign direct investment, however, you see many other countries that have, you know, booked stronger growth rates in FDI than the United States has in recent years.
But in coming to the conclusion, as the study does, that leaders with longer perspectives, this is talking about the people that you survey, the alumni of Harvard Business School, leaders with longer perspectives understand that companies can't thrive for long while their workers and their communities struggle. So that is something that's clearly in the awareness of the business leaders. On the one hand, you're telling us that they expect to do better and they expect their workers to do worse, but at the same time, they're aware of a broader societal condition, right?
Well, certainly the business leaders with a broader perspective do, but we have no claim that that's a huge and growing and healthy portion of the population of business leaders. We hope it is, and it's certainly something we're trying through our project to expand. I mean, there are multiple paths through which businesses suffer in the long run if their communities struggle. First, it's very hard to have a healthy consumer base when consumers are not seeing prosperity themselves. Second, it's hard to hope for pro-business policies when voters are not prospering. And finally, when you ask yourself, why are members of the middle class and the working class having difficulty, you recognize in many ways that difficulty is essentially a canary in the coal mine of business. It's because of weaknesses in the education system, weaknesses in the development of workforce skills that will eventually come back to haunt business.
But the extent to which, as the survey points out, that business leaders in America are reluctant to hire full-time workers, preferring to invest in technology to perform work and outsourcing to third parties or hiring part-time workers, is this, I mean, the American dream was based upon good jobs and good wages. So is this the future, that workers won't have the kind of stability and security that they've been used to in previous decades?
You know, I think when people ask, is this the future, they often believe that there is a preordained future. I think there actually are choices in America today. One future is for us to say, look, it's just inevitable. Forces of globalization, technological change mean that we will see a deteriorating fate for the middle class. Another future says we're going to try to hold back the tide of globalization, technological change, and hope that we can do that. I think there's a third future out there that is possible. It's a future in which business leaders and policymakers and citizens construct a strategy that surrounds our workers with the skills and the education and the infrastructure required to make them so productive that living standards here can improve even in a competitive global economy. So I think we've got a choice. It's actually one of the things that makes this moment such a dangerous moment. In a sense, because of the recovery, we could choose right now to kind of sigh a sigh of relief and say, boy, I'm glad those economic storms are behind us. Or we could say, now's the moment when we've got the resources to invest in making the U.S. a fantastic place to do business and raise living standards. Which will we do?
Well, I'm curious to know, given that you've got access to your alumni, and which I think makes this survey very, very real, My understanding is a lot of Harvard Business School grads are attracted to Wall Street, and because that's where the money is. And is there any sense, though, of the two big questions that I keep hearing from when I talk to economists and analysts of the economy, that one, that the growing financialization of our economy has meant that there's more of a tendency to extract wealth than to create wealth. And then on terms of the consumer economy that you just mentioned, of people not necessarily having a disposable income that would be able to drive an economy which is two-thirds dependent upon consumer spending, that you go back to Henry Ford's adage, which was you have to pay your workers enough to buy your product.
Sure. Sure.
So if you could deal with both of those.
Yeah, so I actually find one of the best parts of my job is that every year I get 1 year older and my students stay exactly the same age. They're always 27. So it's wonderful to have a perspective on what those individuals are thinking about. I see an increasing and inspiring awareness among our MBA students, for instance, that they need to create value before they claim it. And it's certainly something we try very hard to reinforce in the curriculum here. For sure, there will be plenty of people who are pursuing wealth, but they can do it in a way that actually benefits society.
And in terms of the second question about Henry Ford's adage, is there an awareness that you have to pay your workers enough to buy your product?
I'm sorry, awareness in what group?
Well, in amongst the both the alumni and the students, that in other words, you mentioned earlier that people aren't going to the malls, the consumer spending is down, and we have an economy that's two-thirds dependent upon consumer spending. And if that's the engine that drives the economy, then how do you prime the pump,
Sure. Sure. Now, we certainly see among the business leaders with whom we spend time an awareness that that without a prosperous consumer base, it's very hard to sell goods in America. I think there is a question then of who will be the leading firms that will step forward and raise wages as a result. It's an awareness. Now, whether it turns into action broadly is one of the great questions we'll see answered in the future.
So, but just in terms of when you talk about these 27-year-olds that every year, as you get older, they show up. It's a bit like Groundhog Day, I guess. But, some earlier criticism I've read about business schools suggested that there's a lot of sloganeering about, take no prisoners, slash and burn, kind of military analogies. Is that still going on? Is there still this kind of aggressive idea that you've got to get them out the door and get them to be winners, as opposed to implanting, social consciousness and broader awareness of the broader issues, as you've pointed out in this, in the bottom line of your survey here? Is it U.S. businesses winning global markets, but they're not lifting the standards of the average Americans?
So it's very difficult for me to speak to all of business academia, of course. I know within our curriculum we've taken strong steps to make sure that students are aware of the broader environment in which they operate. For instance, for the past decade, all students have been required to take a course on leadership and corporate accountability. And that encourages students to see the world through multiple lenses and to understand their responsibility broadly to society, not simply the economic lens which says, let's make a buck today. I'm reminded of one of our old deans who said, the objective of business is to make a decent profit decently. And we try to reinforce that every day here.
So how can our listeners get hold of this study? Is it? I've read stuff online, analyzing the study, but the actual study itself, how is that accessible?
If you Google the Harvard Business School, the U.S. Competitiveness Project at the Harvard Business School, you will get an opportunity to go to our survey webpage, and you can download not only the current survey but also the past two. And there's also a research tab where you'll get access to all the reports we've done, asking questions like, how can business be more effective at engaging with educators to improve schools in America? So we're doing our very best to make all of this material accessible to everyone. We're eager to make sure that business leaders, policymakers, citizens broadly have a chance to read the material, but also just to debate the ideas.
Well, just in closing, though, one of the things that caught my attention is the idea that a lot of business leaders travel, of course, and that many of your respondents thought that infrastructure, for every respondent who thought infrastructure in the country had improved, we're talking about airports, ports, and roads, nearly five felt it had worsened. And I take it that, you know, you're talking about here the need for better schools, upgraded schools, stronger infrastructure, you know, which would make American workers more productive in the long run and better able to sustain higher wages. So that sounds to me like that is not a debate that we're having in Congress, is it? You know, there was a stimulus after the crash, but there isn't any sense of public investment here. And normally you associate public investment with sort of the canard about socialism. So if business leaders are feeling that the country needs to improve its infrastructure, how are you going to get from A to B because of our political paralysis?
So my colleague, Rosabeth Moss Cantor, is in fact working on exactly this issue around infrastructure. I think all of us here share some frustration that at a moment when we've got crumbling infrastructure in our country, the lowest interest rates that we will ever see in our lifetimes, and underemployment in the construction sector, the notion that we can't at that moment get significant investments in our infrastructure is frustrating.
Well, I think you're being polite.
Yeah. No, the good news here, and there is good news here, is that even as we see paralysis in Washington, there's a lot of exciting activity taking place city by city and state by state around the country. There are many, many mayors and governors who have realized that Washington is not going to help, and they are taking the bull by the horns, taking their fates into their own hands. And so we do see exciting things being done around the country, some of them around infrastructure, some around education, some around the development of the skills base of America, some around reviving the networks of suppliers. The common theme that runs through this is a notion that my colleagues Gary Pisano and Willie Shih have made central in our debates. It's the notion of the industrial commons, that every company draws from some shared resources to be productive. Every company needs an educated populace, a skilled workforce, vibrant networks of suppliers, research universities that provide new ideas, strong infrastructure. And historically in the U.S., government and business have collaborated to build a very productive commons. It's gotten run down in recent years, and now's the time we need to construct a strategy to reinvigorate it.
Well, Jan Rifkin, I thank you so much for joining us here today.
Ian, thank you.
Again, I've been speaking with Jan Rifkin, who's the Bruce V. Rauner Professor and Chair of the Strategy Unit at Harvard Business School. We're going to take a brief station break and back talking about how, as elections become more and more expensive, the need for more and more money is turning our legislators into telemarketers. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Timothy Kuhner, who is a professor of law at Georgia State University College of Law, where he teaches international law, comparative law, human rights, campaign finance, and alternative dispute resolution. His latest book just out is Capitalism versus Democracy, Money in Politics and the Free Market Constitution. Welcome to Background Briefing, Timothy Kuhner.
Thanks for having me, Ian.
And we've just had a discussion about how the economy is doing well for the business sector, but not for the consumer sector, not for the average citizen, and that the wealth disparity is growing in this country, according to a latest survey from the Federal Reserve. So let's talk now about how
our politics are being corrupted by money. And as you argue in your new books, that you know we need to change these rules that corrupt both democracy and capitalism.
Right. Talking about the increasing economic inequality in this prior part of your show really leads straight into the information that I expose in my book. And it's funny because you can go all the way back to Adam Smith in his Wealth of Nations from 1776, published in the year of American Independence, and you see these exact themes foreshadowed, if not really mentioned by name. Smith actually addresses the situation of merchants and master manufacturers, who he says employ the largest capitals, and he says that they're an order of men whose interest has never been exactly the same with that of the public, and who have generally had an interest to deceive and to oppress the public, considering that these classes use their wealth to draw to themselves the greatest share of public attention, and that they desire restraints upon competition. Here's the economic part, restraints upon competition and an increase in profits at the public expense. Smith recommends that proposed laws be long and carefully examined, not only with the most scrupulous, but with the most suspicious attention. And I read that quote because if you go through Thomas Piketty's work on capital in the 21st century, where you get statistics such as the top 10% of U.S. People in terms of wealth controlling 70% of the nation's wealth and the bottom 50% controlling only 2% of that wealth, you have to ask yourself, as does Piketty, how has capitalism become so unsustainable and so unequal? And you see it foreshadowed right at Adam Smith when he's laying down the blueprint for capitalism. He says, watch out for money in politics. And as you say, Ian, it's really been growing exponentially since the 70s especially. And so just to give you one piece of data, there's been an eightfold increase in the cost of the presidential election from $325 million in the year 2000 to $2.4 billion in the year 2012.
So if money is buying our politics, the fact that it's been bought for some time and the role of money, of course, is growing more and more important, surely that there is a connection to the very broader themes that we're talking about here and that the Federal Reserve new report points out. Because if in the halcyon days of the American dream in the 50s and 60s, when under President Eisenhower, the rich were paying 92% tax, and we had from 1947 to 1977 a sort of social democracy, not unlike what the Europeans have. So the fact that the tax system has changed so radically, that's to do with political influence bought by money. So the people who have the money have gotten the rules written in their favor. So that seems to be obvious.
That's exactly right. That's the reason that money in politics corrupts capitalism as well. You see, you can trace subsidies and tariffs and restraints on competition and a lot of market inefficiencies to particular capitalists corrupting the overall system of capitalism. And they do that through this system of indebted office holders, which is a hard pill to swallow. You have to talk in terms of the privatization of democracy. And that privatization process really cements itself beginning in 1976. And it's precisely the time period, the mid-70s up until really the last year, in which economic inequality has soared, money in politics has also soared, and it's been the United States Supreme Court that has liberalized that market.
So do you think the conservative majority on the Supreme Court are acting out of some kind of ideology? Because everything that I'm sure you recall Justice Alito, when the president at the State of the Union castigated the Supreme Court for tearing up 100 years of campaign rules, and Alito mouthed, not true, but the results are true. They're even worse than the president predicted. So what is going on there? Are these guys out of touch, or are they sort of Republican political operatives who see the demographic writing on the wall and want to keep the Republicans competitive over the long haul through voter suppression and a combination of voter suppression and unlimited funds for their wealthy backers? I mean, I know that's a cynical interpretation, but it seems a fairly logical one, unless there's something else I'm missing here.
Right. I think it's a bit of a puzzle as to whether ideology has followed material self-interest, right? Preservation of the party, loyalty to the folks who nominated and appointed them. I also think that there's a possibility that it's ideology serving material self-interest, and it's just a coincidence. But the bottom line is they do really believe these ideas of money as speech, corporations as people, political equality is an unconstitutional reason to reform elections. They believe this stuff, and the opinions from 76 to 2014 are full of very, very strongly held ideological viewpoints. And I can give you one example of that. Citizens United, which is probably the most famous case in this line of Roberts Court cases, liberalizing politics and converting it into a market. Citizens United, which is about the ability of corporations to spend unlimited sums from their general treasury funds, that case came up against Austin, which is a 1990 case that held actually that corporate general treasury expenditures could be limited. And Austin was based on this idea of aggregated capital dominating not just the economy, which is fine, and, you know, query antitrust law if you want, but aggregated capital not just dominating the economy, but also, quote, permitting them to use resources amassed in the economic marketplace to obtain an unfair advantage in the political marketplace. So the court in Austin was saying that transmission process between massive economic inequality and massive political inequality is not okay, right? And the court continued in 2003 in McConnell and said they cited the corrosive and distorting effects of immense aggregations of wealth that are accumulated with the help of the corporate form. And then Citizens United comes along and it overrules those two prior cases, and the explanation is quite simple and elegant. Austin, or this rationale about aggregated capital, interferes with the open marketplace of ideas protected by the First Amendment. The court goes on to say that favoritism and influence for corporate speakers is unavoidable in representative politics, and that representatives naturally favor certain policies, and by virtue of that, the contributors who support them, the donors and the spenders. And so the court, I think they're actually sincere in equating politics with financial markets. And I don't know whether that sincerity actually is a virtue or a defect, because they're so out of touch.
So you started out talking about Adam Smith, and it does seem that Adam Smith's recognition or prediction, I guess, that capital would transcend national sovereignty has happened. We have these corporate inversions going on where American corporations are moving their headquarters overseas in order to avoid paying corporate taxes here in the United States. And it would seem that there, again, is the disconnect between the mobility of capital and the paralysis of people and income earners. I mean, you can move your companies overseas, but people can't move their jobs. They're stuck here jobless.
Right. And I do, you know, the story of money in politics is not necessarily the story of ill-intentioned actors. And it's the story of people playing the game, pushing the limits of the law, as everyone is prone to do, in order to achieve their goals. And I think the same thing happens with corporate inversions. If corporate CEOs and boards of directors have this duty to maximize profits for shareholders, and if they start acting patriotic, right, if they become patriotic with their capital and are avoiding tax havens and tax shelters, but their competitors don't act that way, and they go ahead and they get the benefits of all of that, those corporations, all things equal, will fall behind. And so I do think it's a collective action problem where you need good rules. You can't rely on the consciousness of individual actors who have to exploit the rules, right, as to the extent that's legal, at least, in the furtherance of their duties under law, actually, to maximize profit. And the same thing happens with office holders. They, in order to compete, they have to raise $1 billion for a presidential campaign or $10 million for the Senate, and those numbers keep going up. So naturally, they're turning to wealthy donors and spenders to become viable candidates. And the wealthy donors and spenders, well, when office holders come knocking on the door looking for big contributions and big expenditures, if they say no, they have to worry what happens if their competitors and their counterparts say yes. Will those people get a leg up in the benefits of public policy and legislation? And so I really feel that all of these actors are locked into a very pernicious game, and it's the job of democracy to reform that game so that we can expect decent results.
So if our politics have become more and more about money, and if you make it more about money, he who has the most money wins, and that appears to be the direction that we're heading in. But is there something about the nature of the difference in this country between businessmen and politicians, in other words, that if you're a wealthy businessman or even a Koch brother, if you like, is it true that you would want to hire as your political hireling somebody that's less talented than you, somebody that you could control? Is that what's happening that the talent is not going into politics because you simply cannot, because you have to prostrate yourself so much before mammon to get to where you are, you're not likely to be a person of great integrity or leadership potential. So is it a cynical system that the wealthy want their political agents to be faithful, loyal, and not particularly bright?
I don't know the extent to which that's intentional. I think that's just an inevitable result of a privatized system of elections. But I do see that very thing occurring, and you hear from office holders about their daily routines, which is very much 50% or so of their time dedicated to fundraising, and they become telemarketers, and the candidates who rise to prominence are simply excellent fundraisers, and they know what to say to be on the right side of donors and spenders. And I don't know if that's the wealthy donors and spenders calling the shots or if that's just a self-selection effect of the system as we know it. But the only actor so far who has insisted that the system be the way it is and has protected this dependency of politicians on the wishes of private donors and spenders, the only actor justifying this system is the Supreme Court.
So does this mean, though, that this country's future is one of mediocrity in leadership, overshadowed by short-sighted business oligarchs?
It appears to be that way as a general rule, unless we're able to do something about the court. And I don't think that waiting it out until one or two of the conservative justices retire and simply hoping that there happens to be a Democratic president in office, I mean, that might not even do it. And even if it did it, there's always a chance that the court would swing back the other direction and reaffirm Citizens United and reaffirm this latest McCutcheon case, which allows $3.6 million donations from individuals to candidates and parties and committees. And if we were lucky, we would get a bit of that pendulum swing in the case law. But I think that's completely unacceptable for the bedrock and the foundation of a democracy to be so unpredictable. The financing of campaigns is part of the democratic infrastructure, and it needs to be accounted for in the Constitution. And so I think this ongoing effort to amend the Constitution, which may take several decades or more, is really where the action is in terms of restoring integrity both to politics and to markets, because you really cannot have an efficient and competitive and relatively accessible and sustainable form of capitalism when laws and policies are for sale.
Well, I thank you so much for joining us here today, Timothy Kuhner.
It was a real pleasure, Ian.
Again, I've been speaking with Timothy Kuhner, who's a professor of law at Georgia State University College of Law, where he teaches international law, comparative law, human rights, campaign finance, and alternative dispute resolution. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcast at ianmasters.com. We can also contact me and scroll down on the right-hand side and sign up for iTunes podcasts. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.